Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, we begin this morning with some beautiful live singing. The acclaimed stage show about the life of Maria Callas returns to the National Concert Hall on February the 16th. And with me now from the show are two singers, the baritone Simon Morgan and tenor Patrick Hyland. Thanks so much for coming in to both of you. I think you're going to start off singing the Pearl Fishers duet, and you're accompanied here this morning in our Studio 10 by Aoife O'Sullivan.
Au fond du temple saint, paré de fleurs et d'or, une femme parée,
une femme parée.
My clock 7 minutes past 10 and you're singing like that. Thank you both so much. That is, of course, Simon Morgan and Patrick Hyland, and you're both starring in Callas, the Life and Music of Maria Callas, which is back at the National Concert Hall on Sunday the 16th of February, and tickets from nch.ie, or you can telephone a Dublin number 01417000, and you're accompanied there by Aoife O'Sullivan. You're going off to have a fine slap up fry in our canteen and you'll be back to sing later even better. Thanks so much. We move on. Well, this week there were emotional scenes at the European Parliament as British MEPs said their goodbyes to their colleagues. One of those leaving was Naomi Long, Northern Ireland's only Alliance Party MEP, and she now returns to Stormont to take a position as Minister of Justice. She first entered politics back in 2001 when elected to Belfast City Council, and in 2003 she was elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly for Belfast East and was the first First Alliance Party MP elected to Westminster. She is, of course, now leader of the Alliance Party. And Naomi Long joins me from Belfast. Good morning, Naomi Long.
Well, good morning and thank you for having me today.
Very welcome. Now, listen, Naomi, I just mentioned there, of course, it was an emotional day for many of you in the European Parliament, I suppose, saying your final goodbyes. We have a clip here, actually, of you from the other day, so we're just going to listen to it now.
The decisions you make in this place will continue to shape the lives of the people I represent, and I look forward to forging new ways of ensuring that those close and enduring partnerships built between Northern Ireland and this place flourish. Finally, whilst we will no longer be colleagues in these institutions, I remain your steadfast colleague outside of them, as together we continue to champion the values of cooperation, interdependence and mutual respect, which the European Union represents, until one day we rejoin you here. Au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, slán go fóill, goodbye for now.
That was you, Naomi, of course, on Thursday making your final speech. Was it an emotional day, Naomi?
It was an emotional day, and I have to say that for me it came as something of a shock just how emotional I felt, because I'm passionately European. I'm pro-EU. I was very staunch in terms of wanting to remain in the European Union. But at the same time, I'm a pragmatic politician and I'm not given to shows of huge emotion. So I wasn't expecting it to feel quite as emotional as it did. And even at a personal level, I'd been there for 7-8 months. I'd got to know people. But again, I had known from the beginning that it might be temporary. So it came as a bit of a shock. And I think it was, I think, two things. I think, firstly, there was this kind of outpouring from the other MEPs of kind of regret and sadness at us leaving, but also a huge amount of solidarity and support. And so I think that was quite touching. And then also, I think just for me, it felt like such a reckless thing to do. I said to a friend, it felt like watching someone you care about kind of destroying their life's work, because, you know, I just felt that the UK had contributed so much throughout the last, you know, 47 years to the shaping of the European Union, to building peace in Europe. And to just see that kind of recklessness in walking away, it just felt to me like such a squandering of opportunities.
And of course, you're going to be busy now. You're the Minister for Justice in the Northern Ireland Assembly. You're also leader of the Alliance Party. For my listeners, Naomi, who probably are not as familiar with you as people would be in the North, can we go right back? Tell me about growing up and your background. I think you grew up off the Newtownards Road in East Belfast.
I did. I grew up in inner East Belfast in a very typically working class unionist family in a very loyalist community. So my background, my father worked in the shipyard, my mother had worked in the Belfast Rope Works Company, and then it was at a time when she got married and she had to leave work. So it seems like an awful long time. I'm making myself sound very old, but that was only in 1970. So it's not that long ago when the idea of being a married woman with a job was a strange concept. So I was born into that family. I was an only child. My parents were a little older when they had me. I used to say they were old when they had me, but I'm now that generation, so I don't say that anymore. But they were a bit older when they had me, and so I was born in 71 and grew up really with the Troubles as the backdrop. I was born in December 71, so my whole growing up, the Troubles was there in the background. They protected me, I think, as most parents did with their children, from a lot of the worst of it. But every night on the news, it was part of what I saw and heard, and you know, your normal life was affected by what was going on around you. Your sense of safety and security came from staying in your own neighbourhood with people you knew. And going into Belfast City Centre was a kind of risky activity. So, you know, you did it when you had to, but you didn't do it on a regular basis. So I suppose I grew up with that as my background. I wasn't a political person. I wasn't interested in politics. I didn't see it as something that really brought any value, to be honest, to the community that I grew up in. And that really only changed when I was quite a bit older, when I went to university. the first chance I really had, I guess, to be in a more mixed environment with people from all over Northern Ireland, with people from North and South, people, international students, but also just people from a whole different range of political and religious backgrounds. And it just opened my eyes completely. Two things happened. One was a personal issue that I went to a local politician about, and I asked for help. And the councillor who helped me was John Alderdice, who became the Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly for the Alliance Party. And John sorted the problem out. And that was the first time in my life I thought politics was about practically making a change in people's lives. I kind of made the connection. And I suppose the other thing that happened was in 1994, when we had the first IRA ceasefires. And I was just about to graduate from university. And it was the first time in my life when I thought that things could really change for the better, that there was an opportunity. And I wanted to be part of trying to make that work, because I just knew the way Northern Ireland had been, the way we had lived, was not normal and needed to stop. So I wanted to be part of trying to build a peace. So I joined the Alliance Party because I felt that it was making a difference to people's lives, but also I wanted a shared future. And I looked at the people in that party, and they came from all different backgrounds, politically, religiously, and everything else. And they just seemed to me to typify the kind of Northern Ireland I wanted, which was people working together despite their diversity and actually pulling in the same direction. And so I joined then, but I had no intention ever of being a politician. I was an engineer. I had studied engineering at Queen's, and I went on and worked as a civil engineer for 10 years. And I only ever expected to be a kind of member and volunteer in politics. I had no ambitions personally, politically, and no interest in getting involved in frontline politics.
Interesting. Your mom sounds like she was, you know, a formidable woman. Tell me that story. Wasn't it one time the local people came and they wanted to paint the curbs red, white and blue, and your mom said, no, not outside my house or whatever?
Yeah, my mum was a formidable woman. My dad died when I was 11. And so my mum raised me on her own, working part time. And yeah, she was a strong woman. She had a very strong faith, and she told people what she thought, very direct person and very open person. But on this occasion, it was an odd set of circumstances. It would have been quite normal in the neighbourhood where I grew up for people to put out flags over the 12th on the house, and we had a flagpole on our house and everything else. But this occasion, we had builders working across the street directly from our home, and they were from the south. And some of the neighbours who took exception to this sent some boys around to collect money to paint the curbs. And my mum felt that this was to intimidate the workers who were working opposite our house. So she said no, that she didn't want to pay for the curbs to be painted. She wouldn't give them money for it. But also she said to them that she didn't want them to paint the curbs outside our house. So that was fine. They went away. And when we got up the next morning, they had painted a massive union flag on the road outside our house, just directly outside, with No Surrender, Remember 1690 on it. And so I think my mum was a bit taken aback. And when she went out that morning, the neighbours were watching to see what would be said. And they said, oh, look what's happened. And she said, yeah, she said, and the sad thing is the people who painted it think they respect it. And yet she said people will drive up and down the street over it. And said, I just wonder what they're thinking of. And that kind of resonated with me, because first of all, she stood up for something she believed in, though she was living on her own, essentially, with me there. Just I was only a teenager, so she was standing up to these men on her own, but she was doing it because she believed that the intimidation, and that's what it was, of the people who were just trying to earn a living was wrong, and she needed to speak out. But also she had a sense that she respected the flag, but she didn't use it to abuse other people. It was very important for her that there was it was treated with respect, but that it wasn't used as a symbol to try and intimidate or create a chill factor. And that really resonated with me. And it's something that came back to me much later on when I was dealing with issues around flags and emblems and how you deal with them. And I think she kind of set out for me that, you know, you can respect something without abusing it, and you should treat it with respect. And, you know, yeah, she was formidable.
And actually, funny enough, isn't it right, Naomi, that I think it was around 2012 that there was an unmarked police car guarding your constituency office. But it was petrol bombed in a way because you, I think, as part of the Alliance Party, had voted in Belfast City Hall to restrict the flying of the Union flag. I think it was to 17 specific days.
Yeah, I hadn't actually been part of the vote. I was the deputy leader of the party, but I hadn't been part of the vote. I'd left City Hall by then, but there had been a vote about when the Union flag should fly over City Hall. The legal advice, the equality advice, everything said we should fly it like every other council in the UK, so we should fly it on designated days. Unionists wanted to continue to fly it 365 days a year. And nationalist parties either didn't want to fly it at all or wanted to fly a tricolour and a union flag at the same time. And all the advice said that none of those options really were defensible or right. And it was our party policy that we would fly the flag on designated days because, as I say, we believe that we should be respectful of the Good Friday Agreement, that Northern Ireland is constitutionally part of the UK. But we also recognise this is a divided society. There are people who are Irish who feel very much that they would want their future to be as part of a united Ireland. And we need not to use symbols and emblems to provoke controversy. So we felt that this was an honourable way to respect the flag without making it uncomfortable for people who had a different view. And when the party voted for that in December, there was a lot of literature distributed about tearing down flags, very inflammatory language. And it really unleashed at the time. I'd just been an MP for, I was elected Member of Parliament in 2010 and defeated Peter Robinson, who was the then First Minister and leader of the DUP. In what was, I think, the biggest swing in the UK election. So it was quite a politically volatile time. And the pushback was entirely directed at me in that initial phase. But it then went on. So our offices were attacked. I was sent bullets in the post. I received death threats. My colleagues had their homes attacked, their cars attacked. People were, it was a horrendous time, and it went on, I have to say, not just in kind of 2013 and 14, but right through until I was no longer an MP. So it was kind of 3 years of intimidation, threats, attacks that just persisted because of that decision. We knew when we took the decision it would be controversial. And we knew when we took the decision that it might be difficult. We didn't anticipate just how difficult it would be. But I believe it was the right decision. And I think one of the things that, I guess, when you're in leadership is about having the courage to take the right decision, even when personally it's not a comfortable decision. And it's interesting that with the recent new decade, new approach, it hasn't even been mentioned publicly, but in that document is an agreement from all of the parties to have designated days at the Assembly so that the flag will fly exactly as it does at City Hall. And I think it's telling of how far we've progressed, even in the last 8 years, that no one has batted an eyelid publicly or raised the issue as one of contention. So I suppose sometimes leadership can be painful too. When you make a decision and you see that you suffer for 3, 4, 5 years, the kind of abuse and intimidation, 8 years later, it's as though it's a standard decision. Nobody bats an eyelid. But I think that's a good sign because I think that shows we're moving on. And I think it shows that we're learning how to live together a little bit better, perhaps, than we did before.
Was there ever a moment during the tough times, Naomi, that you thought, I really don't want to do this anymore? I mean, it's tough being a politician a lot of the time, but it's tougher somewhere like Northern Ireland where you can actually get death threats for what you do.
There were times when, I guess, the kind of human bit of, I just can't face any more of this, where you did feel that way. But it was a fleeting thing, because for me, what happened, rather than make me want to leave politics, it convinced me that what we were doing was important. So I think in any political role, you know, you'll think, are we making a difference? Are things changing? Are we creating this shared society? Are we making a contribution? And at that moment, I realized that despite the fact that we had a peace process from 1994, we had the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, we had the St Andrews Agreement then, you know, in 2010. So we had all this kind of moving forward, supposedly. But there was a very thin veneer of democracy kind of covering up what was still a society that believes that when you're aggrieved, when you don't get your own way politically, you can resort to violence and that's acceptable. And that's never been acceptable to me. I was actually only in politics about a year when I got my first death threat over another decision that was made in City Hall. And again, at that stage, I could have walked away and I would have been forgotten. I'd been a councillor for a year. No one would have known who I was, and I would have gone back to living a quiet life. And I made a decision then that wasn't the right decision for me. That the fact that I was getting death threats in 2002 was just evidence that there was work to be done. And that's kind of what's kept me going through those difficult periods.
You also, Naomi, have great support. I think you met your husband, Michael, at your local church youth group, and you got married when you were 23. He's been with you every step of the way, really. I think you both joined the Alliance Party in 95. That's probably been a great support for you through the tough and good times.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I could not do what I do without Michael, because as anyone who knows what politics is like, not just in kind of all politics, can be very all-consuming. It takes a great toll on your personal life. It's a very intensive kind of job to do, but also in the context where our lives were subject to such upheaval, unless you were with someone who was 100% committed and really wanted you to do the job, I would have been coming home at night, and I guess anyone else would have said, give it up, don't put yourself through this. But Michael understood why I so passionately believed that I should do it. And he wasn't just willing to stand by and let it happen, but was actually at the heart of kind of fighting back against it and supporting me and what I was doing. And although he's not a full-time politician, because he's a dentist, so he's got a normal life outside of politics as well. But he's now the group leader in Belfast City Council. And, you know, when a lot of these difficult decisions come up in the council, when a lot of the kind of debate and kind of stuff is going on, particularly during the suspension of the Assembly, there's a lot of focus on that role. And, you know, as a politician, he has also made huge changes. So for me, it's just been a real support to have somebody there who is of like mind, and to have them, for him to remember me before politics, to know who I was when I was a teenager, and just to be grounded, I think has been, I couldn't have done any of it without him.
You've also not just gone through tough political times, Naomi, and come through them, but I mean, as you said earlier, you lost your father when you were only 11, he died. You've actually had and survived melanoma cancer, and you've been very public also about talking about endometriosis, because you think it's very important, I suppose, to put out there the battles you've been through and survived, and to talk about women's issues.
I do. I think that women's health is something that has been taboo for so long. I think in conservative societies, women don't talk about women's health. They don't talk about menstruation and all of those things. People feel squeamish about it, and it's kind of taboo. And as a result of it, 1 in 10 women have endometriosis, and many of those women are not diagnosed until they are well into their adulthood. And as a result, they carry with them all sorts of pain, all sorts of discomfort. It can affect
their health beyond simply their gynecological health. It can affect their ability to have children, and it can affect their ability to hold down a full-time job. And because no one talks about it, no one knows what is normal and what is not. And I think for that reason, a lot of women suffer unnecessarily in silence. And so when I realised initially I had been diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, because no one could work out what it was that was wrong, and it wasn't until I was 40 that they discovered that I actually had stage 4 endometriosis, and that's what was causing the problem.
Well, it's great that you're so open and honest about it. Another day we'll discuss your role as a Minister for Justice as you head into it, which is going to be obviously very challenging but also very interesting. Final question to you, Naomi. I know you're a person of faith, you're a Presbyterian. Is that important to you, and does that help you get through tough times?
It does. I think that faith is important. I think it's part of what builds your character, and it gives you a direction in life. And lots of people obviously will find, if you like, their moral code from other places. But for me, faith was a hugely big part of my growing up, and it was a huge part of my life, and it remains so.
Naomi Long, it's been a pleasure and privilege to talk to you this morning, and best of luck in your new role as, I suppose, leader of the Lions Party. You've been there for a number of years, but as Minister for Justice in Northern Ireland. Thanks so much for chatting to us today.
Thank you.
That's a nice reaction to Naomi Long. Lovely to hear Naomi Long on Marion this morning. Great admiration for her leadership. She's a driving force for a more liberal and fair Northern Ireland. That's from David Whelan. Brian in Dublin says, what a woman. Thank you, Naomi. Always be happy. Maureen in Mohill, what a wonderful lady Naomi Long is. She's an example to all. Never heard her say a wrong word. And another says, lovely to hear Naomi on Marion this morning. Great admiration for her leadership. She's a driving force for a more liberal and fair Northern Ireland. Well, we move on. Sitting beside me is one of our biggest comedy stars. He could also be considered our bravest, often challenging himself in the name of comedy, but also personally, from living with a family in the west of Ireland in order to learn Irish, to living in China, to learn Mandarin, along with lots of other series, including Joy in the Hood. But lately, his comedy has taken on a distinctly personal tone. The life and death of his father, Mike, in My Dad Was Nearly James Bond was a huge success. And now Mia Mama, about his mum, Eileen, who died just March 2019. Des Bishop, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, very good. How are you?
Oh, I'm all right.
You were in Navan last night, didn't
you? Navan last night, yeah. Navan, Portlaoise on Friday, Navan on Saturday, yeah.
Yeah, actually, you're going to lots of different places with your show. They're all on desbishop.net. Actually, you're going to the Project Arts as well, aren't you?
The Project Arts of my Dublin shows, yeah. That's the one thing everyone keeps waiting for me to put on a date in Vicar Street. But this show is in the Project Arts because, you know, there's a bit of theatricality to it. So I said I would go for a run in a smaller venue in Dublin.
And that's from the 23rd of March until April the 4th. Listen, let's go right back. Before we talk about the show and your mum, go right back, because many people forget you grew up in Queens originally. Tell us about your family background.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Queens, Irish American background. My father is an immigrant. You know, he lived actually a lot more of his life in the UK. My parents met, you know, he was at some party in New York. He was a model, you know, and my mother loves good looking men. In fact, she said that she would marry when she met that guy. When she met him, she told her friends immediately, like, I'm going to marry that guy. And so, yeah, I mean, he was an actor and a model. They had an exciting life. I was born in London, to my great shame, which I can't make jokes about now, right after Naomi Long. I'm not going to make any anti-English jokes. But anyway, all joking aside, they immediately moved back to Queens. And then, my parents had like a working class Queens kind of life, which is the life that my mother grew up in. And yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people know I joke about it in the show, but I flunked out of St. Francis Prep when I was 14, which is how I ended up in Ireland. But the rest of my family continued to have that normal sort of Queen's upbringing.
Because to remind people, why did you flunk out? Were you drinking very young? And how did you end up going to school in Ireland? Did they just send you away to try and make you better?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's too complicated, really. It wasn't the drinking, really. I was drinking, but I flunked out. I was being bullied, any number of things. But really, you know, these Catholic high schools had this like academic bottom line, and if you fell below it, you weren't allowed to come back the next year. So I literally just flunked out. I wasn't kicked out for any other reason other than my grades. And, you know, my mother, which, you know, is a theme in the show, my mother had like some bad anxiety. Of course, we didn't talk about anxiety in the 80s. It was just, you know, your mother was a bit mental. You know, like, it just, there was no word for it. But she definitely over worried. And I know a lot of people think that their mothers are like worriers, but my mother was like an over worrier to the point that it was like a chronic problem in our house, which you only become aware of when you get older. But I think part of that anxiety was she literally thought that everything was going to fall apart if something drastic wasn't done with me at that time. And in her defense, a cousin of mine had like big problems with drugs. And she really just saw this horrific future for me. And in that madness, I actually brought up to my mother about going to Ireland to go to boarding school because a cousin of mine had put the idea in my head. And of course, it's bonkers to do that. But for whatever reason, it was simpler to organize than we thought, and we just did it. But I can't say that my mother sent me to Ireland, you know, to punish me. But in the sort of, she always said to me later on that she kind of regretted that I went. But at the time, she thought that I was going to destroy my life and I'd be safer destroying it in Ireland. She actually thought I'd be better off ruining my life here than ruining my life in the States, that somehow I'd get in less trouble. That was her thought, that it'd be a safer place for me to go mental.
Interesting. Now, the whole show, Me and Mama, I mean, first of all, the day your mother died, you did a podcast about that, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, first of all, I just started this new podcast called The Shift, which is actually like a sex and dating podcast. But I used to have the Des Bishop podcast, which is now back up and running. But I had let it slide twice on two different occasions. And I had promised myself that I would get a partner for my new podcast. And having a partner makes it easier to do it every week. And I wouldn't let the listeners down. Mm. And then Tuesday was the day that my mother died, which is the day that you're supposed to record the podcast. And don't ask me why, but I just felt this responsibility to get it up, you know, which is obviously there's plenty of innuendos you could run on that. But I just sat down that night and I just said, I'm just going to speak into this microphone about what I was feeling. And I put it up and I'm kind of glad that I did only because I now have that to listen back to. And I have listened back to it. And it's nice to have. I mean, I guess, you know, I could have written a diary and people probably do, you know, when they're in the middle of such an emotional upheaval. But that was basically just an audio diary of the way that I felt at that time. And even though, obviously, if you're putting up a podcast, you're aware that it's public. And obviously, I'm very comfortable with being public about my stuff. Mm. So that's kind of in me. But then on the flip side, it is nice when you know that people get something out of it. Because everybody is going to, well, not everybody. I mean, there's tragedies that happen. People go before their parents. But the majority of people are going to lose their parents. They're going to have that experience. And a lot of people are going to feel similar stuff, you know? And even if you haven't lost your parents, you may listen to that. And then when it happens, you'll think back to, oh, yeah, I remember that he said that, or, you know, and I just think it's nice to share. It's just a nice thing to share.
No, it's really interesting. But I mean, going back to your relationship, mothers and sons, I mean, you look at your mother differently now, don't you? But you had a tricky enough relationship because she, because of her own background, let's talk about that, had a lot of issues. Like her anxiety was almost rooted, you now believe, in her own upbringing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. I mean, all those revelations come from my mother, you know, particularly after my dad died. Like, I think losing a spouse is tougher than losing your parents. I can't imagine the pain that my mother went through when my dad died. And that was a tough time for her because my mother's whole existence from my birth to her death was worrying about her children, which I think all mothers, you know, feel. But unfortunately, she completely forgot about anything else other than looking after us, which can manifest itself in control and all these negative things. And we just couldn't give back to her what she needed. You need friendships. You need other relationships. You need your own life. She did not have her own life, you know? And from early on when I stopped drinking, I did say to her, Mom, like, you really should get your own life, you know? Because you're not going to get enough from us and from Dad. You need more, you know? So when we were grown and my dad had died, she was left with nothing. I mean, that's like a spiritual emptiness. That's a very, it's tough enough to grieve. It's tough enough to lose your life partner. But then to realize that you've so little else in your life, that's very hard to deal with. And in fairness to her, she faced that head on. You know, she went for therapy. We had a rough patch after that, which was more to do with just her continual coldness and rejection, despite everything that we'd just been through as a family. So on one level, you have sympathy for what she's going through, but on another level, you have your own pain to deal with, and you just think you could just thaw out just for 5 minutes, you know? But anyway, in her defense, she went and she did counseling, and it was then that she came back with the language of anxiety, and she came back with the language of regret, you know, that what she would say is, I thought that everything was going to fall apart all the time, and I thought if I didn't look after everything and control everything, if things weren't done my way, then everything would fall apart and that would be the end of the world. And now I realize that all I was doing was pushing everybody away and driving everybody crazy. And it wasn't deliberate, you know, but she had that realization and she made those amends. I mean, I had made many amends to my mother for my wild youth and all that stuff, but she came back towards the end of her life with those amends. And I mean, it made the end of her life like a strong relationship that we had. It also made it, you know, it made it easier to look after her at the end. Myself and my brothers were looking after her. And I think some people end up looking after their parents with gritted teeth, you know, if they have those relationships with a ton of friction, you know. But we didn't do it like that. I mean, she was still Eileen Bishop, you know. She was still a pain in the hole sometimes. But everybody's tough with, like I get the man flu and I'm a difficult patient. My mother was dealing with a lot of different things. She was a difficult patient at times. But in actual fact, despite all the stress of looking after somebody, it was a good final chapter. I have to say, I was glad that I had it. I have to say, one of the only regrets that I have is I don't think she had come full circle. You know, I still think she gave herself a hard time. And, you know, I said that on a recent podcast, but I do have a little bit of regret that I didn't make it clearer to her that she didn't need to give herself as much of a hard time. You know, I think I had tried, but I probably should have been more forceful to say, you really have to let go of feeling like we think you did a bad job. You know, life it's a long life. It's a full circle. You know, you make mistakes and you learn. And I think she should have been content with the job she did as a mother. But honestly, I don't think she died feeling that, which I feel bad. I mean, you can't, I think everybody, when somebody's gone, there's going to be regret. People say, leave nothing unsaid. And like, you know, it's such an easy thing to say, leave nothing unsaid, but suddenly they're gone and you think, oh God, there was actually stuff to say. So, you know, you're going to be left with a little bit of regret, but I'm pretty happy with the journey of our relationship.
And only because you've already put it out there in a podcast, but I think at the end, I mean, I think any of us who lose people close to us, it's really upsetting. But at the end, you thought she was saying sorry, didn't you?
Well, I mean, she was definitely saying sorry, but it was, I made a joke, which was that she had said like an expletive laden sentence to me about where she wanted her ashes spread. I was asking her, you know, she's like half conscious and I was like shouting in her face, like, where do you want your ashes spread? You know, you feel terrible, but there's kind of like, you have to be quite ignorant with the half conscious. And so it's like roaring in her face, like, where do you want your ashes spread? Because I'd forgotten to ask her. It was like the one thing that I left undone. And so she said, I don't give an F where you spread my ashes, which we all thought was hilarious, such an Eileen Bishop response. And I thought actually for a while that those were her last words, you know, but it turned out actually I'd forgotten that at 5:30 she woke up in a lot of pain and felt a little bad because we hadn't given her her pain pills earlier in the day, only because we thought like she might get a bit more lucid. It wasn't because we were thinking, you know, and by the way, just for the record, the request wasn't from me. It was from other members of my family who said, stop giving her the pills. I wanted to keep giving her the pills, but you can get it. There's a whole other show in caretaker competition and who's the best caretaker. Anyway, she did wake up in pain around like 5:30 PM and, She kept saying sorry, you know. And for a while, I did think that it was because she was being a burden. And I think a lot of people identify with that. It's like, I'm sorry for being such a pain. You know, even though, of course, you don't need to be sorry. We just want to get you back to being comfortable. And but then I did realize that those were the last things that she said to us, like sorry over and over and over. And I can't help but think that that was what was on her mind, just in case, that she wanted to make sure that she left knowing that she felt bad for the job that she did. So that's tough, you know. But I have to say that I was on her Facebook yesterday. I was looking for something, funnily enough, for the show. And I was on her Facebook yesterday. And on March 11th, she had posted this thing about forgiveness, but it was about forgiving yourself. And it was underlined, but I don't think it was her underlining. But it was something along the lines of forgive yourself for the way that you were as a result of trauma. She posted that on March 11th. So I think I'm probably right that that was in her at the end.
And to be fair to your mom, because you discovered afterwards, didn't you, that, I mean, she did have trauma. And the reason, obviously, she became so difficult was because her own parents were both alcoholics. When they, like, she spent a childhood dealing with incredibly difficult parents herself.
Yeah, like yeah. really bad. And I knew that for a while. And in fairness to my mother's sisters, particularly my Aunt Mary, you know, they were very open to me about that. And honestly, it's incomparable, the childhood that my mother had to our childhood. I mean, it was the genuine childhood of alcoholic parents, you know.
Yeah.
My mother had to pull my grandmother. And the funny thing is that my grandmother to me was the epitome of love, you know. And even I remember a couple of years ago, I met my friend's uncle, who was a buddy of my uncle's. And he said to me, just in casual conversation, I was like, you know, your Uncle Kevin's an amazing guy, considering the childhood that he had. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, the mother was really bad. And I didn't know it was like public in the neighborhood that my grandmother was the alcoholic on the road. You know, it was almost like a shame associated with that. So if I have this shame by a distance of this incredible woman, my nan, who I just like couldn't love anymore, was actually this like, you know, terrible parent. And obviously she had her own suffering. I mean, it's just generational, like a lineage of dysfunction. But my mother survived all that. And like, that's why I have a lot of like, I have a lot of sympathy and understanding for my mother, because she had PTSD. I mean, you know, all this language didn't exist. It's so convenient now. I know some people hate the labels of mental health, but it's very convenient to know that she never got over that. I mean, it literally was like a war, you know, like a survival thing in the house. And she was the way she was. I mean, she articulated all that to me. She articulated all that to me, that when she was a child, if she could get her mother in bed and her father in bed and know that now the fear is over. Yeah. If she could alleviate that fear, then she could relax. And so she spent her whole life trying to sort everything out so she could relax. But the truth was that there was nothing to sort out later on. But in her, you know, she just had all the adrenaline, or whatever goes on scientifically in your body between the adrenaline and how your brain reacts to stress. She just lived with that tension all the time, despite its no evidence of it around, you know.
But the fascinating thing, Des, is you turn that into this really successful show. Is that your way almost of dealing with grief, of dealing with loss, of dealing with difficult issues, of dealing with the difficult relationship you used to have with your mother? Well, why turn it into a show?
Well, I mean, I don't know why I turned it into a show, other than I stupidly went to Australia immediately after my mom died. I shouldn't have, really. I should have just taken a break. But I went to Australia because I had this sense that I couldn't let down the audiences. And I, without really thinking about it, I ended up telling some stories about the fact that my mom had just died. And there was some humor in it, you know? And I ran with that. And then I took a break from that because I think it was a bit too tender. But I did say, I'll do it. I'll do a show about my mom. I mean, I had thought about it before. My mother actually asked me many times. I did a show about my dad. My mother asked me many times, like, would you ever do a show about me? And I used to joke and say, I couldn't do a show about you. It'd be too depressing. You know, it'd be too difficult. You know,
but wanted it.
She's too complicated. Yeah. She loved all that. Like, you know, I mean, it's very hard to, you know, we're having like a 20-minute chat. It's very hard to encapsulate our whole relationship, because we actually had a great relationship, because we're much more alike than my dad was. The joke I say in the show is, you know, it was tough when I lost my dad, but after about a year, we were like, wow, this guy did nothing. You know, there's nothing different. I mean, you miss him in the chair, but he was nothing to do with keeping this whole show moving along. You know, like, my mother was the boss. You know, we had a tighter relationship. That relationship to me is more important. So I guess I finally, you know, my mom died, and I saw a way to tell that story. And also because as the years have gone on, you hear more and more about anxiety, you hear more and more about mental health. And I thought, well, this would be my way to talk a bit about that, you know? And also I just found that there was funny stories in the funerals. You know, there's like typical sort of stand-up material that you can do around losing somebody. And then the more difficult part is to try to sort of give a fair representation of my mother. And it's funny because, you know, I did this Irish Times piece last week, and I was very paranoid about talking negatively about aspects of the relationship.
No, it was a really good interview.
Yeah, but the funny thing was, an actor friend of mine came up to me in a cafe yesterday, and she was just like, oh, you know, you're talking about this tough relationship you have with your mom. And I was just so happy to read it, because I'm in the middle of something with my mother. And I was so happy to know that I'm not a bad person, that it's a thing that happens. And sometimes you have to just break, you know, and then it just makes you realize that it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. If you can find a way to make it funny and tell the story, people will get something out of it. I mean, I am in the business of writing jokes and telling jokes. So if you can do it about this incredibly important thing of death and loss and grief and your relationship with a parent, then I would think, why wouldn't you?
And your show about your dad was so successful. I mean, I was just reading all the reviews of it, and they say, lots of people love you, Des. One says, I love Des. I read his book about his dad. I gave it to a woman and her two daughters. The woman's husband, their dad, had terminal cancer, and Des's book helped prepare them to look after him before he died. So thank you, Des. Another says, hi, Miriam. I want to thank Des Bishop for his insight into his mum's life experience. I recognise a lot of me in what he said, and he's given me a lot to reflect on and try to change. I can only time to give you one more. Tom Clonan says, life-affirming interview with Des Bishop. It resonates with the loss of parents. For anyone, I'm still in conversation with my mum and dad, always in dialogue with ourselves.
Mm.
So lots of people.
Well, it's very important relationships. Of course, people, you know, and everybody has their own journey, but there's a lot of people will see similarities, you know.
And your new tour called Mia Mama, it's in an extensive national tour. As you were in Navan last night, you're going from Navan to Newry to Naas, desbishop.net, and you are going to the Project Arts.
Project Arts in Dublin if you're looking for the show. And that, yeah. Because it's in the project, that will be the proper theatrical experience.
And that's from the 23rd of March to April the 4th. You're going to stay with me, Des.
Yes.
We actually have a little surprise for you. We'll take a break. Des Bishop is still with me, and we've been rejoined in studio by baritone Simon Morgan and tenor Patrick Hyland, who are, of course, starring in the acclaimed stage show about the life of Maria Callas, which is returning to the National Concert Hall on February the 16th. Des, lots of love coming in for you. I'm just going to give you one more. Thanks so much to Des for speaking so openly about his relationship with his mum, resonating hugely with me and I'm sure many other Irish people. Now, these wonderful two singers, accompanied by Eva O'Sullivan, are going to sing Ness and Dorman in a minute. But first of all, Des, you tell me that your favourite hymn is Be Not Afraid, and it's connected, obviously, with your mum's funeral. But these two guys, Simon and Patrick, are just going to sing a verse of that for you now. And
thank
for your
you.
Mother.
Wonderful.
Be not afraid. I go before you always. Come, follow me. And
it's such a beautiful
hymn. Thank you very much. You're taking me back.
Beautiful. Listen, on sound today, I want to thank Sheena Neve Wheeler, BCO, Denise Davies, producer Shannon O'Gorman. Callas, of course, as I said, it's on the Sunday, the 16th of February in the National Concert Hall, and you're both going out singing now, accompanied by Eva O'Sullivan, Ness and Dorman.
Ness and Dorman. Purio principessa, nella tua fredda stanza, guardi le stelle che tremano d'amore e di speranza. Ma il mio mistero è chiuso in me, il nome mio nessun saprà. Channel.